Welcome to season 2, episode 2 of the Campfire Conversation. For the viewers, this is actually going to be our first one without like full-time viewers and listeners or full-time like camera work. So you won't see it, but we are back outside for the first time since
We gave the cameraman the night
beautiful
off.
September. Beautiful,
it's
night.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I wore this shirt with the expectation of being on camera. I want the host of this show to know.
Yeah, well, that's me.
We're going to get some video of you.
We will get some video, right. And Jamie's going to catch some good clips. Jamie Schall, our producer, here with us. Jamel Austin.
Is that a Red Hot Chili Peppers?
Give it away now.
And Dr. Ben Sanders with us tonight. Season 2, Episode 2. Jamel, if you could give our listeners a little bit more of an introduction than I just gave for my new friend, Ben, and your old friend, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, not foremost, but shout out to the school network that I currently work for and everybody that is at home listening to this podcast right now. I've run into a few listeners over the last couple of weeks, and it seems like we're pretty popular amongst the charter school crowd.
Yep, DESS, DESS, what?
I wasn't going to say the name of the network.
Yeah,
so
we're Googleable.
That is true. With that being said, introduction of my good friend, my fraternity brother of the only fraternity that actually matters.
Correct.
Mr. Dr. Ben Sanders, great friend, great man, great husband, great father. Unfortunately, he is a Bears fan, though.
Oh, right on,
Bear
man.
Down, baby.
So
Chicago.
Bear down, baby.
And a Bulls fan.
Evanston.
And a Bulls fan.
Yes, absolutely.
Without further ado, Dr. Sanders, can you talk to us about what do you do on a daily basis?
Well, actually, I'm gonna preempt that question very quickly. We just learned something. So you're from Evanston.
Correct.
We got a lot of listeners in the northern Chicago suburbs.
Hey.
My mom went to Northwestern. I went to high school down the street and at Loyola Academy.
Okay.
Right down from Evanston.
Yeah.
Did you go to high school in Evanston?
I did. I went to Evanston Township High
Evanston
School.
Evanston Township.
Ben, I'm going to give you one chance to answer this question.
Okay.
What college did Hugo go to? What does he look? What does he look like?
What do I look like?
What does he look like he went to?
Stereotyping
begin. I don't even have, man. Like, I am the chief equity officer.
Top of
I don't
the morning
even know.
To you.
Morehouse?
good guess,
I was going to say Howard.
Yeah. Close, yeah.
Did you go to college in Illinois?
I went to Northern Indiana. Notre Dame. I was at Notre Dame.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. One of my good friends' wives went to Illinois.
Right on.
Yeah.
So
he definitely looks like he went to Notre Dame.
So second follow-up question, and then before we get into the depth of your job, even just the title.
Yeah.
Best chicken place in Northern Evanston. We went there every week after volleyball.
Oh, yeah.
What place?
You're asking Buff the Joe's? Black guy where he likes
what?
To get chicken?
Buffalo Joe's.
No, man.
You didn't go to Buff Joe's?
Listen, I thought you were... No, absolutely, right? Absolutely. Buff Joe's is classic.
Harold.
I'm not disappointed in you, Josh, because the fact that you know Buff Joe's says a lot about you. And also, I wanted to know how deep into Evanston you had gotten. Because what you need to know is the next time you're in Evanston, I'm actually going home this weekend, there's a place called the Chicken Shack. It's not far from campus.
Okay.
But you gotta
come. I've not been there.
Listen.
You might want to go with a homeboy, though. You can't just go by yourself.
How often do you get home?
Every like 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah. Send me that info.
I'm gonna text it to you right now.
Right on, man. So Evanston, and you're now out here in Denver, of course. And to Jamel's question, we're going to get to the depth of your work in a little bit. But just even for the listeners here, what is the title of your job?
So I serve as the City and County of Denver's Chief Equity Officer. And in that capacity, I'm also Executive Director of our Office of Social Equity and Innovation. So the City of Denver has an office that is committed to enhancing racial and social equity in all of the city's programs, policies, and budgets, right? So it's basically the office represents the city saying, we know that a lot of the racial and social inequities that exist in our city and in society more broadly have been rooted in government practices and policies, many of which are decisions that have just straight up been made. We can talk about some of the history of Denver here in a little bit. And so I'm really happy and proud. I mean, we live in a moment where, we got an election coming up in November where, you know, DEI work or whatever you want to call it, lots of different acronyms mm-hmm. for this work. It's kind of widely under attack, right? Which is not surprising to me if you know anything about the history of this country.
Right.
But I think our office is super important because to me it represents, for me to be able to hold a position like this in a city like Denver means that, I don't want to get too deep too fast, but I'm also an ordained Baptist minister, so I can't help it. it means that our ancestors did something right. Mm. My job, the office that I work in, to me, every day is a reminder of the fact that our ancestors did something right.
Can I jump in real quick? They're both Ben and
Josh. I mean,
Josh.
You just did.
Oh, so. Thank you.
Co-hosting.
I don't know, right?
My question there, and I actually wanted, I did want to get deep fast, pause, is...
We're here.
We're back.
And we're back.
We're here.
No, with the DEI space being under attack the way it is,
yeah,
it feels to me that all of the stuff that we saw in 2020 was very performative. Yeah, like, I'm going to change my Facebook picture to a black screen. We're going to have a DEI officer in mm-hmm. our company.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to donate to, you know, the blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, less than 3 years, or between 3 and 4 years later, it's just like, you know what? We don't need this shit anymore.
Right, yeah.
Talk me through that real quick. Like, how did we get here, and why was it so performative?
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate the question, and I do think there's a lot of performance involved. I think, you know, if you look at a lot of the private sector, I think, you know, a lot of companies are getting rid of the equity programs that just 2.5 years ago they were so deeply and eternally committed to, right?
Right.
I do think that a lot of it was performative and reactive, but I also think that, you know, if we know the history of this country and really just sort of the nature of a democracy, we always are kind of on this kind of swinging pendulum when it comes to being committed to right. moving forward, especially when it comes to race, and more especially, and even most especially, I would argue, when it comes to instances of putting racism in front of us when they're on the other side of, like, black people suffering. And I don't mean that because in a comparative suffering way to say that black suffering is worth more or worse or anything like that. I just mean it to say that, well, I don't believe that, but I just mean it to say that in the United States, because we were literally founded on 2.5 centuries of free labor, and we're a country that prides ourselves on working hard, we've got this fundamental, like, core contradiction. At best, it becomes a paradox for us to work out of, but it's a core contradiction that keeps us from seeing that. And I was saying this when I came. In a second, I'll be happy to tell you the kind of story of how I came to this work. But I was saying 2.5 years ago, when I first came to the Office of Social Equity and Innovation in a different role before this role, when I was in a more entry-level role, that we were in a moment where the sort of window for this work was going to close, and it was going to close fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I felt that way is because as horrible as it was to watch a human being be murdered on film, on camera, and for it to happen during COVID when we couldn't get outside and everybody had to sort of sit and watch it. We had all of this. We had Trayvon Martin and Rekia Boyd, and we had Mike Brown. We had this long string of police-involved killings that predated George Floyd. And so
King.
Yeah, Rodney King, right? Even all the way back. So
in the 90s.
So it's an old tradition. Right, exactly. Yeah, I just mean sort of like in this kind of Black Lives Matter movement, gotcha. This sort of moment. I feel like we had a lot of evidence, and so I thought that one of the reasons I thought that the response to George Floyd, part performative, I do think part sincere, and I'll speak to the sincerity in a second. But one of the reasons I thought it would be so short-lived is because the swing was so hard.
Mm.
It's because you had companies who had never really sort of invested in a meaningful way in racial equity or racial justice or doing things differently and through their programming or through their hiring that will fundamentally change the culture of their organizations. They started to do it, and they wanted to do it overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like, you know, I want to lose 30 pounds, and I'm going to do it tomorrow.
Right? Yeah. I think, I mean, man, we went hard in the paint right Jamel off the
did
bat.
It. Jamel did
good.
It.
You're welcome.
No, this is good. And I think I have a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's necessary. I mean, I think just some of our listeners, this is not a hard question. Actually, I think I want to make sure all of our listeners even understand, kind of, let's zoom back out a little bit.
Right.
What is DEI work?
Yeah,
what does that actually mean?
That's good.
we have listeners across the country. Yeah. And I think people may all have a different take.
You know what it means. It means critical race theory, and we got to get that out of the schools.
Right, exactly. And that's the problem. The problem is that people don't have a real shared definition. So for our listeners who might be, you know, clicking into this and saying, okay, DEI stuff, we're in it. What are we talking about? Ben, what would you say the most appropriate definition of DEI work is in this kind of day and age right now?
I think the most appropriate definition is it's a way that institutions and companies are trying to take holistic and honest looks at how they have participated in, benefited from, and perpetuated systems, policies, procedures that discriminate against certain communities in lasting ways. I think DEI is really the sort of focused commitment of, I'm just speaking here in the United States, mm-hmm. of, again, institutions, companies, organizations trying to get it right by being honest about the past. And in that way, it's not really new work. It is the sort of most recent iteration of ongoing work.
Thank you.
Real quick. I also want to say that it's, I think quite often it gets lost in the race aspect of it, and much more so to black versus white or black and white.
Right.
When we talk about DEI, we're talking about sexual orientation.
Let me break down the acronyms are important. Yeah. Right. Because you'll see it a lot of different ways in a lot of different places. The most popular one, I think, is DEI, which stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. You'll also see EDI, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Here in the city and county of Denver, we use EDI because we want to lead with equity, right? We think diversity means that's great. We want to have a bunch of different people here.
Right.
We think inclusion means we want to include everyone. But equity says we have to look at what folks need to actually be realistically and meaningfully included in a process.
Yep.
So the acronyms change. Yep. You might even see JEDI, which is kind of like justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. But regardless of how you see these different acronyms, they're all reflective of a commitment to learning from the past, being honest about the ways that policies, procedures, systems have disenfranchised or marginalized certain communities, and trying to literally, it's not about disadvantaging anyone. It's literally about saying, okay, we built the system this way so that it functioned this way to disadvantage these folks. So if we build it this way, we create opportunities for everyone to really be a part of the system, be a part of the whole. I think one of the most sort of course, more kind of common misunderstandings of DEI is that it's about taking something from someone. Mm-hmm. And I think... Mm-hmm.
Why do you think people perceive it or experience it or think they might be experiencing it that way?
Because if we can quiet ourselves and think honestly and soberly as we drink whiskey about how terrible some of the things that have happened in the history of this country have been to get us to where we are, if you can come to terms with how terrible it's been, and then you start to think about what it would require to fix it, there's so much suffering involved with coming to terms with what we've been that folks are afraid that it's got to be suffering in, suffering out. Mm. That the only way to undo racism is somebody else has to be somebody's property for 2.5 centuries. As opposed to saying, what have we learned from people who, despite coming to terms with the suffering, have found creative, often nonviolent ways to literally transform how the systems work so that more people can participate in democracy, which, by the way, democracy doesn't work without participation, right? And so I think people run to that scarcity mindset because when you know, and we all know on some level, even if it's kind of subconscious, unconscious, guttural, whatever, how terrible the past has been, it's so hard to imagine creating something new without thinking again, it's got to be suffering in, suffering out. And I just think that's not true, right? And so one of the reasons I'm so grateful for this invitation is because we have to have more conversations about DEI, EDI, JEDI that are rooted in
shout out Luke
what its intention, thank you, Jamel, what it's intended to transform and not just rooted in what folks are afraid it's going to do.
Deep.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah.
I'm not trying to be super deep, y'all.
No. It's... It,
It's the whiskey.
But like, listen, I think part of the premise, you know, coming in, and I think that these questions are going to authentically get there.
Yeah.
Is I think that the challenge in America in general right now as a leader, as somebody, is managing polarities.
Yes.
Right? Like it's either or. It's either pro DEI or anti DEI. And I think if we want to talk in sound bites and go to TikTok, RIP.
Yeah.
If we want to talk in depth, I think that's where one of the reasons that I think this podcast started, and I think one of the spirit of the podcast that we're trying to create is a relatively authentic conversation. And guess what, people? This life is fucking serious.
That's right.
And really difficult to understand. And
that's right.
I know that depth, and no one on this podcast, and I know, you know, we're saying, hey, this got deep quickly, but at the same rate, what's the alternative? We need to create easy-to-understand,
yeah,
you know, palatable, protect-my-comfort sort
right.
of definition of this
That's
work.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is it's
That's
not
right.
comfortable, and it has to be deep because
That's right.
it is. There
no.
isn't anything easy about it.
I couldn't agree with you anymore. Since you're the host, I'll just stay on the deep train. But I also think,
yeah.
you know, one of the beautiful things, and this is one of the things that I love about just sort of my own study of particularly Black history in America, is there's so much beauty and love and joy in telling the truth about hard stuff, right? When you can really get to the point where you can tell the truth about it, it no longer has power over you. Can do all kind of things with it, right?
Yeah,
I think that's how we get jazz. I think that's how you get the blues, right? It's taking that hip hop that you take pain that was never meant to be expressed. It was meant to crush you. And you transform it into something beautiful. That's the beautiful thing, I think, about telling the truth, right? We're so afraid often of having these hard conversations, but I'm telling you, on the other side of it, we're so much more able to be with each other.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Our capacity to be with people that we disagree with is tied to our ability to tell the truth about hard shit, not just the things that are you know, easy to talk about.
I agree. Jamel, what's marinating with
I,
you right
I was.
Now?
I'm not gonna
He's got
lie.
Chicken marinade.
No, I was wondering what was on your index cards.
I mean, there are questions, but you know, I started with a totally different direction, and we're here in a
conversation.
Yeah,
don't let me pull us off the questions, though, because I can do that. So
no, but I do think this would be a good time. What we can do is talk about the bourbon for a minute.
Ah, yes.
And then I'll hop back in. I do want to get back to this management of polarities. Polarities again, kind of being the idea that you have extremes, and I think that's a huge challenge in this country right now, is that we default to that, and I would love to get everyone's perspectives on that. But before that, I think something that doesn't tend to have a lot of polarity, if you drink alcohol and if you like whiskey, is drinking good whiskey. I think most people tend to say, "Yep, I'm in
for good whiskey."
Yeah, me too. So we got a little radio. Is this Radiohead?
Is this Josh on the?
No, this
on
is Tom
snare?
York. This is Tom York.
Is this Yacht Rock?
No, bro. This is one of the best albums. This is from In Rainbows. This is a Radiohead shout out to Tom York and some really innovative early 2000s rock.
I just got here, but Jamie's good at his job.
Thank you. You don't hear that enough in Denver public schools.
I see you, bro. I see you. I mean, good
at his job. Come on, man. Or adequate.
Come on, man.
Jamel is a hater.
Yeah,
this
okay.
is the 92%.
He's a professional hater.
92% professional podcast.
That's right.
Hey. The only 8% holding us back is our producer. But
hey, 80% of the time, my shit works all the time.
So what we're drinking, to everyone's question, is we're going to give Laws another shout-out.
Shout-out
Laws.
We're
going to give a shout-out to our good friend, Criselda Gurrell, who is a fellow friend, a coworker, and what we're drinking is actually really cool. Is this is a bottle of weeded whiskey. And so for a lot of us, you know, who've been, well, the three of us who listen and are on this podcast, Ben, I don't know how much you're familiar with mash bills. So there's a lot of grains in whiskeys, and some whiskeys like a bourbon will have typically 3 grains, sometimes 4. But any whiskey is technically just a grain-based alcohol. And in this case, this is only wheat. So it's only wheat. Wheat tends to present like a lot of chocolatey, for me at least, chocolatey sort of notes.
What do you mean chocolatey?
I was waiting for it.
Yeah, but we do need to point out all of those possible words here. So this is Laws. This is a centennial wheat, and it's also bonded in bottle. Okay. So the other fact here is that Bond, are you familiar with the term or you've heard of it?
Yep.
Yeah, so this was their first, the first ever in the United States bonded and bottled weeded whiskey.
Wow.
There's a ton of bonded and bottled bourbons and other, but this is the only first, the first weeded only bonded and bottled bourbon, or not bourbon, just whiskey.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. That's a lot of bees you just said.
A lot
there.
Of bees. I'm like struggling to get through all the terms in this, but anyways, it's delicious, and it's no longer available in the United States. So this is a bottle that they're only selling in South Korea right now.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, so this isn't one of their 4 years. So to be...
Wait, why South Korea?
I'm not sure. They have a market over there, apparently.
We should ask KZ.
That would be a pretty cool sales job, is to like go promote whiskeys across the world. But yeah, this is a 4 year, and they don't make the 4 year, they do 5 and 6 year bonded and bottled, or bottled and bonded whiskeys. And so yeah, give it a taste.
How many of those did they send you?
They gave it to Jamie, actually, because he helped produce a video.
Because I'm a nice fucking producer.
Jamie, they give you more than one bottle?
Nah, this, I don't think there is more than one bottle. That was the point of this. It's got the number on it.
So
there's one batch. Yeah, one.
I feel like we should just have this one and then put the rest away.
I was just like,
Jamie doesn't drink whiskey.
Yeah,
so
no,
this is
for
us
the
or,
cause. Yeah.
I'm like, this is.
I still stand by my statement.
I'm also like, if that's the only one,
nah, it's fine.
No, we're going.
The laws would say. I mean, I know I'm speaking on behalf of Jamie's gift, but laws. You know, when we did the podcast with Laws back in January, Crystal in their tasting room said basically. The belief of Laws, the guy who founded it, is if you have good whiskey, there's no point in keeping it except to share it with your friends.
I like that.
We're here drinking good whiskey. Jamie has been generous to share this
shout
with us.
Shout out Crystal real
I like
one
that.
Time.
Yeah,
shout,
that's
shout
good.
Shout out Crystal one
I
time.
Produced,
that was a great.
I produced the Principal's rap song.
Is this it?
No, I did not cue that one up. But
I was about to say.
It's for the PSAT. And the vice principal goes hard. She got a whole Ja Rule impression. She was like, I did the whole thing. She was like, oh, that was the wrong take. Can you use this take? And it was like,
I need to hear.
Wow. She was using Ja Rule.
I need to hear this.
No question. It was.
I was. I believe it's actually pronounced Ja Rule.
Okay. What is it?
Did anyone fall faster from frame than Ja Rule?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure some have fallen
faster. Oh, yeah. I can't think of
OJ
right
Simpson.
Oh, no. OJ was. You could argue OJ was famous until
now.
He's
famous until now all of his movies are out.
Yeah, and then he was infamous.
Yeah. Would you rather be
RIP OJ?
We'll ask this question, we'll transition back. Would you rather be famous or infamous, Jamel?
Famous. Respected, I would say.
You can be infamous and respected. So you didn't answer.
You are throwing me off with
these
nature sounds right now, bro. This shit
changing
is
the question.
Crazy.
Just embrace it.
The woodpecker is crazy.
Let the birds come for you. I would rather be famous or infamous. Ooh, that's actually pretty tough.
Yeah.
Perception, subjectivity, all that stuff. I'm gonna go infamous.
Huh.
You wanna elaborate?
I think that a lot of the folks that I admire and that we tend to admire were more infamous than famous when they were alive.
When they were alive, okay.
When they were alive.
I got you.
When they were alive.
I got you.
They were more infamous
definitely
than they were famous.
Definitely shortening the lifespan to be infamous.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You, okay. Hugo?
Yeah. I mean, I think the way Ben answered it is kind of what I was leaning towards. Honestly, hadn't thought of, like, fame or infamy are not words that honestly.
I love when you ask questions and you have not even thought about them before you ask them.
I'm an excellent manager because I just ask people to do things and I don't do them myself. I think infamy and fame are not words that often come to my own, like, it's not part of what I incorporate into how I think about how I operate. But yeah, I think infamy is almost a harder thing to do because you're being countercultural. And I think there's some value, there's an incredible value to that, right? Like, I mean,
yeah.
Jesus probably died pretty damn infamous.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And,
right.
You know,
no,
just using him as an example. But
yeah, that's spot on.
And I think that to your point, Ben, like the idea of infamy carries a negative connotation. Sure, there are some people who are infamous who are just lousy people.
Yeah.
And that's not the version of infamy I would want. But
yeah.
I guess if I were to say, like, if I really wanted to live big, and I feel like that would be a goal in the second stage of life, the second half of life, most likely, I hope, at least a half I have left.
Mm-hmm.
would hope be you have to more live than bigger. Half. You know, live bigger. Like, what else do you have, right?
I hope you have more than half.
I hope I have more than half, but, you know, that would be 78, man. That's beyond the average lifespan of an American male. I'm
trying to tell you. Don't take these years for granted, man.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Since you asked the question, would you rather fly or be invisible?
Like, be able to jump up and just fly around?
Mm-hmm.
Shoot, that'd be good. Fly.
Now, think about everything that comes entailed with that. Like, if you're in an airplane flying right now, outside is pretty fucking cold.
I'd have a jacket, you know?
Like a light jacket.
A thick one.
He's got his answer.
I feel like I'd take flying because at this point, all of the reasons I would want to be invisible, I should probably not be invisible for.
Yeah, it's a horny choice.
I was listening to This American Life, a podcast, and they had posed the question, and somebody had said that anybody who chooses invisible is inherently sneaky.
That's good. No, that's kind of how I feel. I start thinking about the top five things I do as soon as I had the ability to make myself invisible, and I'm like,
if you're flying, you're just flying by yourself. You can't like carry somebody with you. You know what I'm saying? So like you're just flying by yourself.
Have you ever just watched birds? Have you ever just like the ones that were just peaceful place?
Yeah, I have.
And just watch birds. Like,
I have.
Float.
I watch birds all the time.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
How great would that be?
Yeah.
I was out in Glenwood Springs this weekend with Lindy, and we were out of this hot spring.
My wife and I love Glenwood.
Oh man, we were at the Iron Mountain Hot Springs.
We go up there all the time.
Right on. We're right on the river, and there's just all of these ravens just floating in the sky. Like
Wait,
they
hold
weren't
the
even
fuck
flapping
up.
Their
How
wings.
Do you know they're ravens?
Because that's
because some of us can recognize birds, Jamel, and by us I mean them.
Nevermore.
Yeah. So I was like, man, birds. And
I'm
and
almost pretty sure they're not ravens. I'm gonna hold
think
you to
were.
That.
They were.
No,
I think
there's
no,
ravens.
No, I want you to prove
ravens.
I want you to prove that it's a raven.
Well, let's fucking.
It's probably a fucking bird. Crow. Now that I think about it.
People know birds. That's like a. That's
I don't.
Wait. Okay.
My wife is a really good. She's got a really good eye for birds.
She's a birder.
Is it an ornithologist?
Is that what it is? Ornithologist.
I'm gonna give you guys. I know I've already derailed the podcast already, but I'm gonna give you guys my bird story, and then we're gonna move on.
Yeah.
Waiting this birds.
Please make this good.
So you guys all know the neighborhood that I live in. I'm not gonna say it on the pod, but
he lives at.
So up the street from
that, it's like talking about the Trump jury right now. It's like the media, like, hey, we're not gonna let.
We're not gonna tell you who
you know,
these people
he's,
are.
He's just assistant vice principal at this school in Northern New York. And his wife, you know, she's a doctor,
so
but we don't want to give
That's
any
so
more
bad.
Information.
We're not
going to
give
this.
You any more information.
So yeah. And she commutes on the 45A bus at 8:15 every
That's
morning.
Right. His favorite bagel shop is located.
So
yeah, there's no cops ever in that neighborhood.
Up the street from my old house, you get to the stop sign and then you cross over and there's a long street. And I was trying to do like a 5-mile walk. So I'm on my walk. I'm walking and I have my headphones in. And I'm walking, and on my right, I see two birds. They could have been ravens.
Probably crows in Denver.
They were two birds sitting on the fence, and they're looking at me. I'm looking at them. I'm looking at them. They're looking at me, and I'm like, man, fuck these birds. So I keep walking, and then I'm listening to a podcast or something like that, and all of a sudden I hear like a go past my ear, and I'm like,
buzzed you.
I was like, what the fuck was that? So I turn around and look, and the birds are no longer on the fence. I turn and look in the sky, and this motherfucker is dive bombing me.
By his nest.
Then, so like I'm like, what the fuck? And then it came and hit me, and another one tried to come and hit me, and I'm take off running. And it was like it was an angry bird. Like
don't get mad. Listen, the birds felt that animosity.
Right,
you
but
shot
so check,
their way.
But
when
check
you
this shit
away.
Out. So yeah. Like well, there, there's it was a
anybody can get it.
Listen to this. Of course, it was a black bird
with a red chest.
With a red chest.
Yeah, dude, those are very protective. Those
right,
are,
right.
I don't know.
So,
but yeah, they will swoop at you this
yeah,
time of year.
So I'll
sure.
tell you guys.
And
I'm,
you gave them an aggressive look, so whose fault is this?
I was at the time, I think, a 35, 36-year-old man, full on sprinting up in the middle of the fucking street, trying to get away from these birds, right? And so I go up there. I'm like, yo, that shit was crazy as fuck, dog. So I go up there, and then on the way back down, I'm like, yo, I'm on the other side of the street, man. Fuck these fucking birds. These motherfuckers come after me again from the other side of the street. So I had to take off running back to the crib. I was so mad. I was like, yo, I'm going to get my shotgun. I'm going to shoot these fucking birds. I was mad as fuck at these fucking birds. And then I go and look up. I was like, who are these black birds with the red chest? I look it up and whatever the fuck their name are, but they're like a protected species.
Super, oh,
You can't do anything to them because you could go to jail for that
you
shit.
You couldn't do nothing but with they, the birds anyway. Them birds was from the mess.
Oh, I was going to shoot the fuck out of those birds.
That's your answer to everything, Jamel.
Exactly. But come to find out, like Hugo had said, or I think you said, Ben, I had walked past their nest. I was like not too far from the nest, and it was like mating season at that point or whatever. Yeah, they, so they thought I was intimidating to them, and they were trying to take me out. Which brings us back to DEI.
Yeah, which does, I think. What other forces right now, Ben, that you see trying to take out? We don't need to answer what the forces are.
Right.
So managing the polarity here, one end of this extreme is we're banning it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
Yeah.
What do you think, and we're starting to get there before, what do you think is one of the impetuses behind that push? And you were starting to share, it's this idea of, and I'm probably going to misquote it, but pain in, pain out, or
yeah, like suffering in, out. Somebody got suffering out.
Do you want to break that down a little bit more? I thought that term was really fascinating, but could you tell me honestly what you mean by that?
I think, you know, to speak to the question and without falling too much into the polarity piece, because I do think it's important that's just so ineffective right now the way a lot of us relate to people with whom we disagree. But I do think this, man. I think there has to be, in order for discourse to be reasonable, there have to be certain things that we say are unreasonable.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, in order for me and you to have a conversation that's meaningful, we have to agree on, like, there's a certain level of agreement we have just sort of in the conversation. If we're talking about,
basketball.
Right, exactly. If we're talking about basketball and I start naming tennis players, well, it's just out of, right? We may have all sorts of arguments about, if we're talking about who the greatest basketball player is, you may say, oh, well, you know, you got to think about eras, or you got to think about that. But we know we're talking about basketball. One of the things that's really scary about attacks on DEI, and this is going to sound super corny, and I don't mean this to polarize anyone. So if anyone feels polarized by this, please know that that is not my intention. There's something I believe fundamentally anti-democratic about banning books, banning ideas about how we ought to learn from history. We're not banning it. So I just think that we ought to be very concerned about, because we don't want polarity. We want the ability to live in a society where we can get together with people that we disagree with, and we can still have deeply meaningful and even transformative conversations. But the moment we start to ban things out of a sort of, I just think, and I know that this works both ways, and I really do kind of mean it both ways. Like, I mean, there's certain things I think we should ban and render illegal, but the things we've been banning recently, we don't have to talk about the forces, but we can talk about really public things that have happened. Reversals around affirmative action. Some of the things that could be coming down the pipe related to supplier diversity and attacks on programs that invest in opportunity for minority and women-owned businesses, because we know those businesses tend to be the most disenfranchised. I mean, we're literally taking apart programs that at one point we said, because of what we know to be true, these programs, these ways of being, these ways of thinking are essential.
I think the issue there is because you said these are things that we know to be true, and now that is in question.
And what is considered, we've always had the ability to do this a little bit. I mean, if you talk to folks who were really committed to segregation during the civil rights movement, they probably thought that integration was like irrational and just stupid, right? And like shouldn't even be considered. And so there's always that level on which it's like, well, there's the whole sort of universal scale and everybody's got to decide what. But I just think when we start banning ideas that were 50 years ago fundamental to helping us be faithful to the idea of democracy, something is happening, right? And I want to say that while at the same time saying I welcome conversations with people all the time, each and every single day, just as a way of being, that see the world differently than me.
Right.
I don't like just talking to people who see the world like I do, but I also don't want to ban people who see the world differently than me.
Yeah, and I think the challenge you mentioned, Ben, I think is one of the challenges to democracy right now is the dissolution of truth, right? Yeah. I think that, you know, yes, I think everyone can have their truth.
Correct.
And I think there's a value in saying, hey, your truth is your lived experience. It's what you bring to the table.
Yep.
It's what you understand to be there. But when faced with a different truth, then we're like, nope, that's just not, that's not the the reality. And I think truth is maybe the wrong word. It's almost like fact. Do we agree, like, is the moon rising over the
That's
horizon?
Really what we're talking about. It's fact.
That's fact.
That's a good correction. Yeah, my brain is tired. It really is fact.
That's what I was going to say with that. Because
it's fact.
There is your own truth, like your lived experience.
That's always going to be debatable.
And then there is, like, no, you lost the election.
Right. Yeah. And that is a fact.
Yeah. Quantitatively.
The challenge, I think, facing people trying to navigate these complex spaces in which there will be disagreement, there will be questions, there will be spaces in which people will have, you know, variance,
different opinions.
Is sometimes it's very difficult to sit in the arena with somebody who's like, now, today is Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no, today is Wednesday.
It's
like,
actually,
you know,
Wednesday.
What? I, in my heart, in my gut, I just,
it's
and
Thursday.
I think that there's been some real strategic Machiavellian, like, dishonesty that's been intentionally created for decades, arguably, in this country, for beyond decades, because at the end of the day, people are afraid of the truth. People are afraid of the facts. And if you tell everyone you have to agree on these facts to be able to have a discussion, that means you have to face some of the facts that are really uncomfortable. So instead of facing that, well, why don't we start to just put doubts into the people's minds that we're not going to touch race, we're not going to touch sexism, we're not going to touch poverty, but what we can touch is, like, we're just going to have two fully different arenas in which to talk, and therefore there won't ever even be a feasible space in which we can dialogue. And I think that's the scariest part right now, to see how that has happened consistently since our country's been formed, but arguably really consistently since the early 90s. And so, I think that's been really hard.
So when we talk about Machiavelli, are we talking about 16th century Machiavelli or
the concept
20th
of, like,
century
deceit.
Machiavelli?
Who is that one?
Tupac.
Both. We can talk about both.
We can. Yeah.
See what I did there?
I did. I said, I saw exactly
you saw
where
the setup.
You
saw,
I saw exactly
yeah.
where you were going.
Yeah.
So you know,
I appreciate that.
I think, you know, again, anyway, your question, the kind of heart of your question was about sort of suffering in, suffering out. And I just think that the idea that has to be is something that, you know, we just got to develop the courage to lay that down because it's keeping us from a lot. It's keeping us from a lot. But I know you got other questions.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess staying in that same realm. So, and I wrote the name down, but a gentleman over at Harvard this past week.
The Ivy League questions?
on a Thursday?
Yeah, I know. We're going there. But yeah, so I think Dr. Randall Kennedy is at the Harvard Law School.
Yeah.
He kind of has kind of come into the news recently with his kind of concerns about these mandatory DEI statements that employers are requiring their employees to commit to. And I'm sure they take various forms, whether it's an affirmation of an existing statement or a, we need you to affirm this in your own words. And he came out, and he's African-American, and he came out and said, I think that these statements are, and I don't want to misquote it, but essentially like the ideological pledges of allegiance, and doesn't believe that they are actually serving the interests of DEI work. And to note, he is a left-leaning, socially, like, social justice-oriented academic. And so I'm curious if, it sounds like, Ben, you've heard
a little bit about it. I don't know enough about it.
But even just the concept of these DEI statements, what do you think in terms of companies? Why are they doing it? Is it more of an extension of the performative? Does it have, like, what are your, well, yeah, what do you think
real,
about
real,
it?
Real quick before you answer that, how did you guys feel about saying the Pledge of Allegiance growing up?
I learned that I had to do it at the beginning of the day.
It
was a function of starting the school day.
But did you have a feeling about saying it?
No.
Did you have a Hugo about saying
it? I didn't. I mean,
it was a ritual.
Yeah.
I didn't think twice about it. And I grew up in a religious household. So rituals are just part of existence.
And I think it goes to your question a little bit, Hugo, but my mom specifically, because as light skinned as she is, she's probably the blackest person I know. But she was just like, hey, like, you're going to say the Pledge of Allegiance, but don't believe that shit. As a matter of fact, if you don't feel like saying it, you don't have to say it.
Mm, yeah.
Because it was so performative and it was something that she really didn't believe in. Right. Specifically, I'm not pledging allegiance to a flag.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know the refrain or the sentences that come after it. But to your point, Josh, like, of somebody having to say, hey, like, I pledge allegiance to thinking equally, or, you know, pledge allegiance to equality, and somebody actually doesn't believe that, right. Like, it's, why are we making somebody do that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I get it. I think one, I don't know enough about that particular case, and I want to understand the concern about the relationship between the pledges and what is actually not happening. At the city and county of Denver, I'm really glad that city council opens every city council meeting with a land acknowledgement. We're trying to get a labor acknowledgement added to that. They also say the Pledge of Allegiance at the outset of every meeting, right? What are they doing?
Contradictory?
No. No. It's all a part of what it means to be in that space, to be in the city and county of Denver.
Mm.
They're almost saying, and I love this, we pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and so we're going to read this land in this labor acknowledgement. I don't think it's contradictory at all.
We're going to get deep on this, but I think that is my biggest issue with the hypocrisy of the United States, right? Like, if we actually held true to the values or the things that we said we are supposed to, the United States would be in such a much better position, right? Like, so this whole all men were created equal, oh, except for the blacks, and now we got to put a constitutional amendment in. Mm-hmm. Or except for women, okay, now we got to put a constitutional amendment in to make sure they can vote. Mm-hmm. But everything else is good, and then it's just like you have to keep putting these, but it's like if you just would have held true to what you said originally, you wouldn't have had to put into these fucking amendments.
But
right?
it was never held true to. I mean, this is the thing that I think is both beautiful and hard, and but we have to keep in mind about the founding documents of this country. They were always aspirational. They were always about who we were committing ourselves to being, but also becoming and maintaining over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the documents about them, the nature, they have to be malleable. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things.
But today, it would seem like it's ironclad. Like, this is the Constitution, and this is...
Cause well, that's trash.
If somebody proposed an amendment to the United States Constitution in 2024,
yeah,
it would be an uproar.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That, I mean, that's sort of constitutional originalist approach, right? The idea that there's an intention there that is sort of... is and should be sort of locked away from time, space, and condition, and we should just remain consistent with what the intention of the founding fathers was. I mean, it's just not realistic, man. It doesn't work. It's similar to folks who want to read scripture to get the Bible or something like that to get an idea of how to be good to their car.
Yeah, be very literal. Yeah,
right. I mean, you have to be able to adjust for time and space. So I think that's messed up. But I want to go. I don't want to move too quickly away from the Harvard question because it's an important one, right? I didn't just want to sort of make that city council sort of mic drop moment because our office, like we have an office that is charged with establishing metrics for the advancement of racial and social equity. So what's an example of that, right? One of the things that's really interesting to note about the city and county of Denver is that we know, like every city, we have certain areas that are underserved. You can really sort of figure out where those areas are by figuring out where the highways are and sort of working out, as most as is the case in most U.S. cities.
Right.
But did you know that in some of the most underserved neighborhoods in the city of Denver, you also find the least amount of tree coverage? That is to say that in some of the neighborhoods where folks have the greatest need, they also have the least amount of trees. And we know how hot it gets in Denver, how hot it's getting every year.
Respiratory illnesses.
What that does to air quality, respiratory illnesses, right. and things like that, right? So it's not just, I mean, it's environmental stuff. It's about heat. It's about, so to me, I don't think that the statements themselves are a problem. I think it sounds to me like, and I need to, again, sort of read up more on this particular story, but it sounds to me like the complaint is really about the emptiness of the sort of action that these statements are supposed to represent.
And
for me, right, I mean, I lead an office where our, the reason we exist is to try to make sure programming at the city doesn't just create statements, but creates measurable outcomes.
Right. I appreciate that. And I think it is the right, it is a tension because it's not literally just about DEI sometimes. I also think it's, you know, the concept of where do rituals fit?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I grew up, my dad is Catholic. My mom is Jewish. I grew up confirmed Catholic.
Shout out Pittsburgh.
Yeah, Pittsburgh is where my dad's from. And,
okay.
Yeah, grew up in the Chicago area. My mom really ensured that our family as we grew up.
The real Midwest.
The real Midwest. Yeah, we were having Friday night Sabbath. And so I grew up with ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I sat through a lot of boring church services. Mm-hmm. And I sat through a lot of, you know, Friday night Shabbats that thankfully, you know, at least in my experience, Jewish people incorporate food and drink into their rituals faster and quicker. But those rituals you don't think about when you're doing it. In fact, sometimes when you're a kid, you're like, shit, I can't wait to be done with these rituals. But I feel like in my own life, a lot of rituals left the table. And I mean, I'm going to celebrate Passover with my kids tomorrow.
Beautiful.
Which would be great. And there's something so important about these rituals because until you don't have them or you choose not to keep them, you almost don't realize what you're missing. And so, yeah, you say the Pledge of Allegiance, but do you really think about what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
You say these DEI affirmations, whatever they may look like in these companies, but do you really think about what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you get rid of them, though, you're hoping that, hey, we can't be performative in saying these things, so let's just get to the depth and the art and like the living of these values that are said in words that we kind of hit in this rote sort of manner. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
That's, of course, the goal. You shouldn't just say the DEI statement. You shouldn't just say the Pledge of Allegiance. You shouldn't just say the Our Father. You should pray it. You should think it. You should internalize it. But, of course, we don't do that 99% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you don't have those rituals, what do you lose?
No, I think that's absolutely right. The sort of, like all of us, I have a long story. So before I was working for the city and county of Denver, I was actually a seminary professor for 6 years. I have a
Denver?
Like Pet Cemetery?
No, seminary.
Oh.
Seminary, Jamel.
Sorry.
Come on, you can do this.
Pet Cemetery 2 is one of my favorite movies.
No, I moved out here in Denver in 2008 originally to start a PhD program at the University of Denver in Iliff School of Theology. So
I have
a PhD in theology and social ethics, and I taught those topics for about 6 years at a small seminary in St. Louis before coming back to the city and doing this. And so I don't know how to think of, you know, I don't. I was talking to Jamel on my way here. I was like, which hat am I? You know, I'm still sort of the pivot away from higher education wasn't something that I ever planned.
Mm.
And so a career in local government wasn't anything I ever planned.
We're going to have to talk after the podcast because.
Oh, we can talk on the podcast.
Yeah,
too.
But keep going with what you're saying.
Yeah, because I don't know how to. I mean, I still think that kind of like. So to me, I don't know how to existence speak about the fact that. No.
One, thank you for saying that, Ben. We got to get back to it and acknowledging people's conversations. I learned that from Josh, so thank you for saying that, Ben.
Learned that from my fault. I received the feedback, I modeled it, and now the whole we understand.
Yep.
Yeah.
So going tapping into your your divinity side, if you will.
Yeah.
We had this conversation, I believe, in season one with John Clark.
Yeah.
If
go Irish.
God personified. What does God look like? What is if God was to walk through this door right now, what would they look like?
I have no idea, man. I have no idea what God looks like.
Well, give us something, like a sketch.
Can I answer that first? I have a quick thought.
Yeah.
I think to me, God looks like a tree branch swaying with my movement on a hammock.
I like that.
I was camping.
You got to give me more.
A few summers ago, and was, it was up in this beautiful hike to only place about 3 miles off the road, and the storm was blowing in across the mountains just to the north. Actually, Mount, it's no longer Mount Evans. It is called Mount
Blue Sky.
Blue Sky. Thank you. Mm. And I was looking towards this mountain, and this dark storm's blowing in, and it was drizzling, and I was lying on this hammock, and I was just kind of breathing in this fresh mountain air. And it, I think as I just kind of slowly moved my foot, the hammock would bounce, and then this tree about 50 feet above me, the leaves would kind of sway in response. And it was just this harmonious connection.
That's it.
To the universe.
That's it.
And to me, that is what God means to me at this stage in life, which is, for better or for worse, a relatively a religious stage in my life, but I do not feel spiritually devoid at the moment.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that would be my image, is this tree just kind of bouncing with me.
That's way better than I have no idea, by the way.
I was going to say, thank you for that, Josh, because I was really like where is he going with this thing? And like I said, on the podcast with John Clark, shout out Irish, I said, to me, my personification, my thought, when I think of God, I think of a black woman. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the political sphere, because time after time after time, black women have saved this country from itself.
Yeah.
So many fucking times. And to me, God has saved me from me.
Yeah.
So many times, and has been there even for me, even when I wasn't there for myself, and has led me down paths that have always been great for myself. Even when I couldn't see it for myself, and history has shown me in my life that it's generally black women who have had my back, generally black women who have helped me down, generally black women that have always done the things for me, even when I haven't done it for myself. For me,
that's big facts.
When I think of God, I think of a black woman. So
that's why I love
that
metaphor. Jamel knows that when I was when I was a seminary professor, I spent a lot of time working in an area known as liberation theology. There's lots of different perspectives across the world: Latin American liberation theology, Asian American liberation theology, and of course, Black liberation theology here in the United States. And so, those traditions, especially and when they're Christian traditions, they spend a lot of time talking about the identity of kind of Jesus, right? And sort of what it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, certain traditions claim that Jesus is black, or Jesus is Asian, or Jesus, is best understood through the experience of a black woman. Mm-hmm. So I think all of that is real. I think that the question of God for me is a little different. And I love the sort of metaphorical approach that y'all have taken. One of my favorite scholars, a guy named Howard Thurman, who was a mentor and teacher of Martin Luther King Jr., was a master at using metaphors to describe experiences with, with the divine. And I think he's got this. One of my favorite metaphors of Thurman is what he calls the inward sea.
The what sea?
The inward sea.
Oh.
Inward.
Like inward. Within.
Yeah, like
not
in all of us, and each
not
of us.
The inward.
No, inward.
Gotcha.
Inward, not inward.
Yeah.
Still kind of sounds like you're saying.
No. Howard Thurman
was not saying the inward.
Was not saying inward. He was saying inward. He was probably called the inward than 20 times in his life, though. The idea that all of us has an inward sea.
S-E-A, like a...
S-E-A.
Mm.
And Thurman says, and in that sea there's an island. And on that sea there's an altar. And before that altar is an angel with a flaming sword. And he says, nothing gets past that angel with the flaming sword to be placed on the altar of your inward sea without the inner authority of basically your choice on its brow. There's something about agency, choice, unavoidable freedom that we have, like the responsibility. We've spent a lot of time in this country talking about the freedom we don't have, but we often hate the responsibility of the freedom that we do have. Mm-hmm. There's something about the freedom of choice that brings us really close to God. Because I believe fundamentally one of the things I believe deepest about us is that God created us to be free and to experience all that comes with that. The good stuff, the bad stuff, the terrifying stuff, the comforting stuff. So I love the metaphor of an inward sea that kind of reminds us of our own responsibility to shape our lives and the things that matter most, right? And I love to do that, and I love to meet other people who are doing that, because when you meet folks who are really committed to that, you can, especially folks you disagree with,
Yeah.
You can have some of the greatest, most enlightening conversations you will ever have.
What, so, I'm sorry. I'm
hit me with it.
This inward see
concept,
in concept of inward see, it, are you saying, or is Mr. Thurman saying,
mm-hmm.
nothing can happen to you without your choice of it happening
no,
to
no,
you?
No. He's saying the most important things in your life are not the most important things in your life because anyone else makes them important.
It's because
they're the
you
most
make
important,
them important
things because you choose.
Gotcha.
It.
Okay.
You choose it over. Shit is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
That's part of life. But the things that are most valuable, the things that you choose to protect, those things have what he would call the stamp of your inner authority upon their brow. It's the thing that gives your life meaning. So in the midst of all the things that are going to happen to you as just a byproduct of being here, the thing that gives you deepest meaning is your ability to choose that value and then remain faithful to it.
Well, while we're on that subject or that thought again, thank you, Ben.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
Of choice and thought and what you choose to protect, how can you, in the real world, not in the real world, but in let's take a step out of the
in these streets. You want to talk about these streets?
Right.
I know how you are.
Yeah.
Talk about these streets.
How do you rectify that thought, that philosophy, with like getting a job or being in a job that you actually enjoy or being where you're wanted. Right, like, and what I'm trying to do is steer the conversation towards this
mm-hmm.
path of careers and mm-hmm. the choice that you make in your career or where you're going along this career path.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did those two line up? Like,
such a complex question. Are we suspending financial and economic factors?
No, I think
moment?
It all has to be. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think you gotta consider
that's the
all
realest
of
part of this conversation.
That's where I'm
is
getting
like,
at. That's where I'm
my
getting
oldest
at.
Stepson is 18.
Yeah,
you can be a lot of things next year. You can't be in my house not doing nothing.
Right,
right.
Yeah, that, right.
And his inward C is like, I don't want to get up and go to work.
That's right. His
more.
Inward C is PS5.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's where I'm saying, like, so in the reality of it, I love the philosophy of it, but yeah. in the reality of it, how do you rectify those two?
Yeah, things? In case he hears this, my 18-year-old's inward see is actually not PS5. He's a brilliant young man. He's got a lot of great stuff ahead of him. So how do you reconcile the idea of an inward see with the idea of responsibility? I think they go together because responsibility, again, I think it's a part of being here, right? You're going to get older. You're going to go from the kid who can play all day at the barbecue to the kid who's now being asked to carry stuff. And now they're the young man who's being asked to pick stuff up in the store. Now you're the adult who's being asked to buy stuff and bring it to the bar. I mean, that's responsibility is just a part of, I think, being in any sort of community where there's sort of like social roles and any sort of meaningful thing like that. But I think in any context like that, you still have to make choices about what's most important. And I think when you do that, and when we empower young people to do that and hold them responsible for doing that, right? Yeah, I want you to be a kid. Yeah, I want you to figure out what you want to do. I also want you to like try something and stick to it, right? Don't quit it the first time it feels uncomfortable. Let it shape you a little bit, right? I think having values and teaching young people that you're not going to not quit because, you know, you couldn't quit. You're going to not quit because you don't quit. You see things through, right? You instill that early as a value. And I think when you do that, you end up with young people who embrace responsibility. And we don't have nearly enough of this. I know y'all know it's true. Mm-hmm. They embrace responsibility without a centered sense of why they're here. And so they embrace it with fear. They embrace it with anxiety. They embrace it with insecurity. They embrace it with all the things social media teaches us, right? Because they've never been taught and they haven't seen modeled, what does it look like to make a decision about the kind of person I want to be and to struggle as imperfect as I am to really stay faithful to that and be responsible out of that? Not, right? Not I got to take care of my responsibilities and I'm going to try to be a good person while I do it.
Yeah.
Right? No, we're shaping people who they, you know, you are responsible out of a sense of why you're here, sense of
choice,
community,
and
a black woman, you know what I'm saying? All of that.
Yeah, I mean, so many good motifs, if you will, within this conversation. And I think,
can I
like,
ask a quick one?
Yeah.
Before we
yeah.
Oh no, he just said motifs. I was waiting for
yes.
motifs to come out.
Yeah, I'm just saying we were talking about connection. We're talking about God, spirituality, choice, diversity, equity, inclusion. Jamie.
Yeah, just like for any 18-year-old living in our care, what's like the range of acceptable ways that they're spending their time? Because I know like we're talking about the almighty dollar, but like is it like you have to be bringing, you know, like financial resources to the family, or like what is the range of acceptable ways
for an 18-year-old?
Yeah, for him to be spending his time and living under your roof and having it feel like whole.
Yeah, and I want to preface this by saying, you know, there's a sacred responsibility in each parent-child relationship, and a sacred relationship there. So I wouldn't pretend to be able to speak universally about this. But to me, the goal is really much more about, I don't know if it's as much about specific roles and do's and don'ts, but like going back to the sort of, if we do a good job of sort of honing young people who are at least curious about living valued-centered lives, and they also live, you know, not to be too corny, but purpose-driven lives, you know what I'm saying? Like they'll want their interest and their hobbies grow into things that they spend more and more time doing. I mean, it's basically the structure of the university system. You're supposed to pick a major because by that time you spent enough time, no one has, but exploring stuff to sort of choose what you think you want to do as an undergraduate student. So you're going to get a degree in what you're going to contribute to society. That's what your degree says. I'm going to take this degree. This is how I'm going to give back, right? I mean, that's really, I'm a former academic, so I'm a nerd about this stuff, but that's really the sort of idea of the academy. You go here, you take your sort of purpose-driven life, you shape it under some people who have done this and thought about it, and then you go and you make your contribution. For me, having 18-year-olds who have a sense of purpose is such a rare thing right now. Like I don't mean to kind of down this generation, because they have, you know, as always said, challenges we never could have imagined. They got social media and stuff like that. I mean, the stuff, they have the world in their pockets. It's hard to develop a clear sense of purpose and a clear sense of what's most important when as your brain is forming, like algorithms are telling you what you think is most important, right? So I don't have a straightforward line, but I do think that the sweet spot is getting young people focused on hobbies, sort of pro-social, proactive activities that really get them in spaces that focus them on living lives that are centered in something that matters deeply, not just the response they're going to get.
Yeah.
Well, and I might want to try that again, but not in terms of recording, but just in terms of saying it again. But I think that's what I mean.
I love it, and I can't speak for everyone's fathers, but I know like our father's generation, in large part, was like feeling a responsibility to prepare us for the workforce.
Exactly.
In a way that what like I heard in your answer was deeper, and I think like a lot healthier.
Yeah.
We're talking like 18-year-olds. I'm talking about a 45-year-old man. Mm-hmm. Like, how do I fulfill that responsibility?
Really, without your authority, nothing gets put on that altar. I think to hear to us and what makes us happy. Because
we live in a capitalistic society.
Some of it is that. Some of it is because we're being sort of driven towards the workforce sometimes before we're ready. Though I don't think that workforce preparation is necessarily a bad thing, right? It's just all about sort of, you know, how you shape the educational journey and how folks find their way into the society. But I think some of it is in a society. You know what? That is it. That is the core of it. It is. It's the capitalistic thing, because in a society where, in a society literally founded on a desire for profit and expansion in the name of, you know, expanding what we know about the world, so on and so forth, it is hard to overly justify the type of space where everybody would have the space to kind of discover what they want to do. And so it's sad that a lot of 45-year-old folks have gotten to 45 and have never spent time, never had time, never had the opportunity, never had the training, never had the preparation to go, what do I really want?
Right.
What makes me happy? When I'm done, if I'm 45 and I'm by most measures more than halfway through,
right,
what's going to make these last 30, these last 20, these last 25 the most meaningful to me when I'm, right? I mean, I actually do this a lot. I put myself on my deathbed when I'm trying to make decisions about stuff. And I ask myself, when I get there, which would I which would I regret missing more? Would I regret? So there was a time when I had to make a decision about being a professor and moving back to Denver to basically, you know, be with my stepkids.
Yeah.
I'd worked for Jamel, you know, for over a decade to be a seminary professor. I'd put a whole lot of my years, you know, the real fleshy stuff.
Right.
Into getting there.
Yeah.
But when I got to the point where my wife and I were trying to decide what was most important for us, it was a no-brainer, man.
I was going to say, was it a no-brainer?
It was a no-brainer, but it was a hard no-brainer.
Yeah.
Because I knew exactly what I was going to do. And it also meant that my vocation slash identity was going to change in a way I hadn't planned. And that was going to be hard.
Understood. Yeah.
Follow-up question.
Yeah.
Is that deathbed a sleep number?
I don't know, man. I hope so.
It's a Serta.
I hope when I'm...
Is it a pillow top?
I don't know.
If I'm on a sleep number when I'm on my deathbed, I'd be very grateful.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
but
right.
In all seriousness.
That's a good question.
Is it one of those infomercial ones that you can lean up?
Oh, shit, it fucking jammed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh, it's crushing me.
I want to be... Yeah.
We don't want one of those versions.
I should have spent more time doing core.
No, but but no, it's a good question to ask. And I think this is when I mentioned, like, hey, we should talk after because we're about to close. But in many ways, and for listeners on here, I've announced over the last couple weeks to my team at work and to the ethernet, the interwebs about my decision to step away from my role after 17 years and working in schools. And it's been a hard decision. But at the same point, what I have clarity of is not necessarily the exact next step, but that there do become moments in life when you get to this place. And I'm going to try to tie this together to where we started with DEI, but also this concept, I think, where we've shifted here a little bit, you know, from thinking about religion and spirituality to, in many ways, the core of, I think, what faith traditions, what spiritual traditions, and frankly, a spiritual traditions do, which is the importance of human agency.
Yeah.
And the importance of human choice. And I think for me, I've come to kind of understand that so much of my life up until this age of almost 40 has been a lot of shoulds and a lot of, like, you know, shouldn'ts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost living through this lens or this sense that you're doing what is expected of you,
yeah,
but you are not choosing. And
that's right.
I think when you get to this place of, like, you know what, I want to choose something, even if it doesn't feel the most rational, even if it doesn't feel the most reasonable economically, even if it doesn't feel like the safest or the most comfortable, this power of choice, whether you see it in your baby when they don't want to, you know, be in their crib, all the way up to, you know, 98-year-olds who want to still drive their cars.
Yeah.
Right?
Shout
human
out Joe
agency.
Biden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Choice is such a core part, and this agency piece is such a core part. And I think the importance in my mind, many pieces of DEI work that is important, is that if we're not thinking about how we've eliminated choices and agency from so many people based on our systems and structures, that we are limiting the ability of people to be truly liberated.
That's
and I think that
right.
that is how, for me, this conversation ties together. And I really appreciate the questions, you know, there's no asides, right? Everything is part of the conversation. I think
it is,
at least if we're being intentional, because whether it's God or freedom or choice or jobs or careers or DEI, it's all part of people trying to live their best lives. I think one of the goals of these conversations is, for me personally, to reflect on it with friends and new friends and to share ideas and thoughts and concepts for people to find ways to connect better. I hope that, you know, for me, this conversation has been illuminating. So, Ben, I really appreciate your insights, your expertise, your reflectiveness. And so thanks for being on the show, man.
Absolutely.
Pleasure to be here, man. I mean, I think, you know, if just to close, I think as a you know, person of faith, I think we were created for freedom. I think we measure our sort of individual freedom by the agency stuff we're talking about. You measure our collective freedom by how well we learn to value the most vulnerable among us. And I'm trying to take that and give it really good expression in the form of public service and local government, man. And I think we can sort of sort of enliven that thing inside of all of us that wants so badly to be free, and that understands that we can't get there until other people are there. Man, we really can. We can model for a lot of other cities in this country in a time where we need it so desperately what it looks like to be more committed to being free than being scared.
If I may, right on. Hugo, can I steal your closing line?
No, this is you. You're the last man to close.
Wait, we're going to let Jamel close?
Wait, no, actually, kind of, but no.
It's a Jedi situation.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. All right, I'm ready.
Ben, what did you learn today?
Oh, man, I learned... I learned that there are some incredible people in this part of town. I learned that there is a ton of a potential in talking to folks about topics that you're not prepared to talk about with openness, because it can transform you and how you see folks.
Right on.
Josh, what'd you learn today?
Yeah, I think I appreciate, I think that the learning for me in this conversation is that honestly, some of my questions, Ben, were like, what do you like most about your work?
Yeah.
What don't you like? And those things came out, but that you can't have a conversation that is so critical to people's existence. I mean, you're talking about the two letters of DEI, like the equity piece and the inclusion piece.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we crave, opportunities to succeed and the feeling that we belong.
Yep.
And you can't have this conversation without going deep. And I learned that there's also a real calling that exists in each of us. And I think that as I'm in this personal phase of kind of discernment, it's both reassuring and inspiring to kind of think about the importance of being called to those spaces where you can carve out an impact to do that. So I appreciate you guys.
Appreciate y'all, man.
Jamel? Jamie,
I was going to say.
Yeah, it's good to be around people who are, like, living their values and feel alive. Like, I can feel all the life in each of you. And
trying, man.
Yeah, it's they're trying to beat it out of us. So
that's all right. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, it's just great to be around you, and I love how this conversation's evolving over the.
Back at you, man.
Yeah,
y'all got to bring me back, man.
Yeah, for sure.
So I've been.
We're all out of time.
I know. As we close,
play out music. Music.
I know, right? I've only been the chief equity officer for a short time, and I'm really looking forward to some of the things that we're working on and talking to y'all about them. So
yeah, that would be the other part. I agree. We're gonna have a part two. As a citizen of this great city for now 16 years, and the parent of two boys who go to schools in this town, and
right on.
An educator who's helped work with thousands of families and kids,
yeah.
I care about the city. I would love to know what we're doing in that space. So you
we
have
gotta
an
talk
invite
newcomers.
Back.
We gotta talk. We got
dude. We got a lot to talk about. Let's get into the hot topics of the city and the politics and the actions. Yeah, definitely, Ben. You're back. I'll bend Jamel's arm. We got it. Jamel, what did you learn?
Don't let him make important decisions.
What did I learn? I learned about Mr. Thurman, and that the only things that are the things that are placed on your altar are by your choice. And with that being said, Hugo, take us out.
Thanks, guys. This is good. This song actually was a song that played for me in my junior year of high school when we went out into Lower Wabash. And we made sandwiches and went to homeless shelters to learn about, like, the experience of people going through stuff that a lot of kids in my high school didn't know about.
Wow.
And we listened to this Red Hot Chili Peppers song, which is called Under the Bridge.
Educators matter.
Yeah, man. And we got around, and that changed. That was socially justice grounding for me for sure.
Wow.
And I think just made me realize, like, we're called to do more than what we have in front of us.
That's right, man. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks, y'all.
What kind of sandwiches were they?
Ham and cheese, man. Turkey. We had some vegan options. I don't think we knew it was vegan at the time.
I don't think there was any vegan options.
Yeah, peanut butter and jelly, man. Thanks, guys. Season 2, episode 2. Thanks, guys.
Blessings,
Campfire Conversations, y'all.